Hello. Welcome to the Western Carolina University Entrepreneurship Program interview series. My name is Aisha Wilson, and this, I am conducting a telephone interview with Mr. Harry Brule, who is a board member of a nonprofit organization called Veterans Green Jobs. Welcome to the series, Mr. Brule.
Thanks.
Okay, so we will just begin with a little bit of background information about you, if we can. Just a little bit about your education, your career path, what led you to Veterans Green Jobs, please.
Sure. And again, I'm just a board member of Veterans Green Jobs, and my day-to-day job is I'm the CEO of the Southwest Conservation Corps. And I've been in working with conservation corps for 19 years. I got out of college as a civil engineer, did that for a year, and decided it wasn't the direction I wanted to go, and joined a local service corps in North Carolina, Durham. Was there for 3 years, and then went and worked at their National Association of Conservation Corps up in Washington, now called the Corps Network, on a variety of different positions there, ending as COO, and then moved out to Colorado to work with the Southwest Conservation Corps, which is now headquartered in Durango, Colorado, and has 4 regional offices across the Southwest. And in addition, I am also a board member of Veterans Green Jobs.
Excellent. So in your background, you don't have formal education in environmental services or business, it doesn't sound. It sounds like a lot of this was just self-interest and you on-the-job training kind of thing. Is that true?
Yeah, I would say that's mostly true. I do have a degree in civil engineering, and it was in the environmental option of civil engineering.
Okay.
So there is somewhat of a tie, but basically, yes, it's all learning as you go, which I think is true in many nonprofit organization.
Okay, fabulous. Let's talk just a little bit about Veterans Green Jobs, which is, as we stated earlier, you are a board member. Could you please talk a little bit about Veterans Green Jobs' mission, their services, and the programs that they offer?
Yeah, so Veterans Green Jobs was founded a couple of years ago with the idea that we had a large number of returning veterans from these overseas wars in Iraq and Afghanistan coming back looking for new ways to get plugged in, to get engaged in the state upon their return, and also at the same time sort of a burgeoning field in the green jobs arena. And so the idea was to connect these returning veterans on a new sort of mission of service working in the green jobs arena here in America. And so the program has focused on a few different areas. One is on training veterans for jobs in weatherization and then employing them through some large weatherization contracts in Colorado. A second part has been, and I went back up and also in Northern Virginia. There's a program doing that as well, Veteran Green Jobs there. A second piece has been around training veterans for other green jobs fields in conjunction with some community colleges, both in Pennsylvania and in Colorado. And then a third area has been training vets for conservation area fields, and this has been done primarily in partnership with existing conservation corps, including the Southwest Conservation Corps. And these are veterans trained in fire management industry, wildfire protection, cutting trees in dangerous areas, and getting prepared and trained to be wildland firefighters, as well as sort of other conservation areas around trail building and maintenance, habitat restoration, urban tree greening, and so on.
Outstanding. Like you're doing a lot of great things there. I would like to focus on the Southwest Conservation Corps program, of which you are CEO. And could you describe it in just a little bit more depth? meaning how long do the teams go out, and what regional areas do you cover the entire country, that sort of thing?
So Southwest Conservation Corps engages young people, diverse group of young men and women, and organizes them to work on and complete very important conservation projects. We have a variety of programs to do that, from working with middle school youth all the way up to people who have graduate degrees. And at each step along the way, work to have an age-appropriate response. So the youngest kids work in their own community for 4 weeks in the summer, while the folks who have graduate degrees are placed individually in watershed associations or with state agencies and serve for an entire year. And that's sort of the gamut. And in the middle, we have sort of from the middle school kids, then when they're in high school, they're often camping for a month at a time, sometimes 2 months at a time, coming back every other weekend, usually in a front country situation at a campground or a national park and doing conservation work. As they get older, they get into more technical programs, including very technical rock work and trail work, fire mitigation, a lot of projects in the backcountry where they're hiking in quite a ways to their work site and staying 2 or 3 weeks at one site. Those programs last anywhere from 3 months to 6 months, sometimes even 9 months. Then there are a number of leadership programs training folks to be leaders. Each group that goes out is typically around 8 people when they go as a group. And then the individual placements are really the older ones with more degrees and college degrees and graduate degrees, and they're working for typically a whole year, though sometimes shorter periods, with a specific agency, building their capacity, generating more volunteers. In terms of location, we have offices in Durango and Salida, Colorado. So those are kind of southwest and south central parts of the state. Acoma Pueblo, New Mexico, which is a Native American place just outside of Albuquerque, about 50 miles west of Albuquerque, and then Tucson, Arizona, way in southern Arizona. And we operate these group programs over a very large area that geographically is the size of the state of California, going from just over the California line, all of southern Arizona, most of New Mexico, a little bit into Texas, and then good portions of Colorado and little bits of Utah. For individual placements, we do even broader, and we have right now folks placed West Virginia, Virginia, Pennsylvania, Alabama, Tennessee, all the way up to Alaska. So those can spread quite a ways across the country. But the vast majority of what we're doing is in the Southwest.
Wow, fantastic. So we mentioned the link with returning veterans earlier in the interview, and I'd like to kind of focus on that a bit. So you mentioned sort of why you formed the program. What are the program's goals, and what has been the response to this, both by the participants and by the community at large?
Well, there's been a great response to engaging returning vets from the agencies, especially. These are projects typically funded at this point by the Forest Service and the BLM, so they're very interested in it, I think, for a number of reasons, besides their patriotic deal with it. Another big piece is that these agencies are losing a lot of their folks to retirement. The baby boom generation is coming out. They're looking for who's going to come in and replace and be the next sort of wave of employees in these agencies, and see returning vets as a great option for that. And so there's been a lot of joining of missions in those areas. In terms of the vets themselves, it's taken a little bit of time, as of sort of any new program, to sort of hit into the communities where the vets are, to get the word out about the program and get folks interested in coming and being a part of it. And we've had a lot of lessons learned, among them that this younger generation of vets has been much less likely to be involved with the traditional veteran service organization and more likely to be poking around things like Facebook and Craigslist and sort of online media places. Another sort of lesson for us has been that veterans, as opposed to a lot of the people we engage, are less interested as a whole, not certainly there are many exceptions, but as a whole, less interested in sort of a service experience and more interested in something that's preparing them directly for a job. So it's been a learning process in that way, but in general it's been a neat sort of meeting of a couple different needs coming together around a common purpose.
Thank you for that. Let's then focus on some of the nuts and bolts aspects of the Southwest Conservation Corps, if you will, if we could. Let's talk a little bit about the business structure that is nonprofit and that sort of thing. And how did you initially approach these government agencies to form this?
Well, the organization itself is a nonprofit. And the business structure is that we generate about 80-85% of our revenue from agreements with federal land management agencies. And my experience is that, frankly, it's easier to do this in the West than the East, where there is much more federal land in the West, and sort of more of a culture of the East Conservation Corps working. So that for many of the land managers, it's not a new concept. And the trick is always sort of how do you break in? Because once you break in, our experience is that there's a lot of support for what we're doing. So typically the ways to break in are to bring other resources to the table, grant money that can support a crew, AmeriCorps dollars, use a volunteer project, develop the personal relationships with the land managers, and sort of build up so that we can gain their confidence and develop strong relationships, and they can see the product that we're doing and see it as a valuable partnership for them, both for getting the work done as well as engaging either local young people or veterans or another population that's important for them to engage. In many ways, it's not dissimilar to how the for-profit sector works in attracting new business and generating clients.
Okay. And does your organization work exclusively with federal lands, or do you also work in state lands and other public lands as well?
Yeah, we do all kinds. I think out west, federal lands is the vast majority, but we certainly do work with state parks departments and a few different states, wildlife agencies, and local cities and towns and their public parks and towns.
Okay. So you touched just briefly on some of the funding sources. Would you discuss that a little bit more in depth, your funding models, and as well as the current state of charitable giving and access to grants in this very tough recession?
Yeah, we don't really rely on grants and charitable giving. At least at this point in time, makes it easier for us. We have a much more sort of entrepreneurial model where we go out and create these partnerships, and that's what supports our agency. So we're about a $5.5 million agency right now, and over $4.5 million comes from project partners. We get 10% of our money from AmeriCorps, and then the rest is sort of pieced together on a bunch of much smaller sources, but I think that, yes, both charitable giving and grants are tough right now. It's a very competitive environment, and you have to have a compelling mission and a compelling purpose for the money. And in our case, rather than doing fundraisers, which we don't do any of, or individual donors, which we do very, very tiny bit of, it's much easier to generate resources by creating these partnerships with federal agencies.
Have you accessed the corporate market in any way for grants or donations or anything like that, either now or in the past? past, or do you have any desire to do that in the future?
We've done a little bit with some of the corporate foundations. The areas that we're most interested in, we are interested in moving in that direction, and we haven't done a whole lot yet. But our interest is finding companies that have a joint and shared objective. For instance, outdoor industry companies that are making products that we're already using in the field. We think there'd be a natural affinity for them to have a group of young people using their products and using them well, and they are the next generation of stewards and outdoor recreation enthusiasts. So we've been having some meetings with that companies or representatives of companies in that area. We're trying to move a little closer there. But again, I mean, those companies are also being squeezed in this economy. And they're being squeezed as well by the new, sort of younger generation that is not going outside as much. So if you make backpacks or hiking boots or water bottles, the demographic of who's going to buy your product is shrinking. And so we're one of the agencies out there that is increasing the number of young people that go outside and take advantage of outdoors and begin to appreciate and become, hopefully lifelong users of outdoor recreation. So we see a natural affinity for some of those companies to wanting to get attached to what we're doing and other conservation boards around the country are doing. And we're working in that direction, but we don't have the broad scale partnerships in place yet that we would at some day like to have.
Well, we certainly wish you great success in that endeavor and trying to get some of our young people back to enjoying the outdoors. And so let's move on a little bit. You touched earlier on Facebook and that sort of thing for contacting participants. Please tell us a little bit, Mr. Brule, about your marketing techniques for Southwest Conservation Corps and Veterans Green Jobs as well. What avenues have you found most effective for communicating with potential participants as well as people in general?
Well, we pretty much have two primary markets that we're after. One is young people who want to participate, and another is potential project partners and funders. And so with the young people, it's a lot of electronic media, social networking, Facebook and websites and blog postings and getting position announcements out on websites that folks are looking at. There's still a lot of face-to-face, especially with populations that perhaps aren't as networked. We still do a lot of recruiting on the Native American reservations around the Southwest and in some of the smaller communities. This year and last year, we've each gotten about 2,000 more applicants than we have positions for. The applications are pouring in. It's not certainly an issue of having to find people. But we continue to sort of do outreach and connection. On the other side, the funder and partner side, we found that there's a lot less of the online. And that the website of ours is more of sort of a brochure website for them where they come and get information and learn about what we're doing and see what we've done rather than make it an interactive tool. And that kind of marketing, for the large part, remains word of mouth and connecting with people at an individual level, at the unit level, at the park level, the forest level, sometimes at the regional or national level. And then hoping they talk to their friends at other parks to kind of spread the word around. So it's been a much more traditional kind of approach on that side.
Okay. Have you considered using a professional marketing organization to take a more perhaps aggressive approach, or have you considered there is some sort of kind of charity aggregators and evaluation entities that sort of make this information more available to potential donors. Have you considered any of that sort of thing?
Well, if you recall from sort of our model, individual donors is at this point not really part of our funding mix. Mm-hmm. So we haven't targeted the individual donor in that respect. We're not out there sort of doing broad membership campaigns or direct mail or telephone solicitation. Part is that we're a fairly targeted program, and that our sort of best potential for individual donors is our participants and their families. And we've grown so quickly in the 6 years I've been here. We've been from serving 73 a year to over 900 a year. So that in the early years, we do not have a very large membership base to sort of go back to. So we're just beginning to sort of go those ways. But then unlike someone like the Nature Conservancy or some of the Sierra Club, some of the much, much larger organizations, we're not at this point sort of doing direct appeal to the public. So it has not been, at least for my analysis, cost effective to put a lot of effort into the individual donor arena right now. So we've not done any of the charity aggregators or any of the sort of professional marketing, because our marketing niche we're going to is fairly narrow, and at this point, you know, from the participant side, we're overwhelmed with applicants, and from the project partner side, I'm not sure how helpful that would be, except potentially having nicer materials.
Okay. Thank you for that. Let's ask, how do you select people to join the SCC, both as staff, as well as do you have any criteria for accepting or not accepting potential participants? Are there, for example, mental or physical injuries that some of these people may have sustained that they are not suitable to this sort of work?
Sure. The general kind of focus for us is accepting and engaging the people who will benefit most from the program. And that statement certainly has a lot of leeway, but it cuts out, in a way, people on both ends. It cuts out people who are doing so well they're going to do great if they're not in our program. We want to hit people that are really going to take advantage of it and have this become a life-changing experience. On the other hand, if someone either physically or mentally is not in a place where they can do the program, it also cuts that out. So we work to screen and find the people who are best able to be prepared and to participate in the program.
Okay. And this is not a completely volunteer program. I don't suspect you. Provide a stipend to participants.
Yep.
And so let's talk a little bit about that. How are you able to do that within the nonprofit structure, and what how do you decide how to motivate and reward people in general?
Well, there's no prohibition against a nonprofit organization having paid employees.
Right.
And we tend to have, this year will be about 1,000, a little over 1,000 employees. And so that is perfectly legal, acceptable, understandable for a nonprofit. There's nothing within a nonprofit structure that would make any problems with that. So that's easy. And then each program has its own sort of parameters when someone comes on about what the allowance rate is. Most of them end with the opportunity to earn an AmeriCorps scholarship called the AmeriCorps Education Award. So they get a living allowance, they get the AmeriCorps Education Award at the end. The year-long programs, they get health insurance. But all of that is laid out. And typically their motivation has never been an issue. We have a lot of people applying to us, many more than we can take. And again, answer. That's back to picking the people who really want to be there and are really going to benefit from the program. And we end up having a retention rate of just around 90% each year.
Okay. I guess one of the questions I was trying to ask, maybe didn't do it as elegantly as I wanted. How do you decide on what levels the living allowances are and that sort of thing? Is it what do you use as kind of an industry standard, I guess, is my question.
Oh, sure. The industry standard is around minimum wage. Mm-hmm. So it's a ballpark of around $300 a week for a participant and a ballpark of $500 a week for a crew leader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and give or take 10 to 20% depending on the program.
And is that sort of is that linked to a certain number of hours worked per week?
Or it's full time.
Okay. And are people typically, especially with the fire crews and things like that, people can run into beyond overtime quite rapidly. Is there a structure to compensate for that?
Yeah, we don't fight fires.
Oh, okay.
So when they're on a crew with us, they're not doing overtime, they're not on fires.
Okay.
Typically, they're getting training and they're doing mitigation, which is cutting hazardous trees in usually in a wildland urban interface area.
Okay. Okay.
So they would leave us at the end of a program and graduate and get hired by an agency to be on a fire crew. But we don't run into those issues at all.
Okay.
But you're right, those would come up in a typical firefighting program.
Okay. Thank you. So let's talk about, because you are the CEO of this organization, the Southwest Conservation Corps, as well as a board member of the Veterans Green Jobs, you have a lot of things happening in your day, and I thank you for taking a little bit of time today during a work day to accept this interview and participate. Could you please describe a typical day of Mr. Harry Brule?
Well, I don't think there is a typical day. I'm pretty much on the phone or responding to stuff coming in or meeting with folks pretty much all day.
Mm-hmm.
With little snippets here and there to catch up on work. I tend to travel quite a bit, mostly because we're a regional office, regional organization with offices spread out, you know, 750 miles from one office to the two business offices apart from each other. And I tend to go to Washington about every 6 weeks and to Denver every 2 or 3 months.
So most of what you're engaged in is administration, information exchange, coordination, that sort of thing, rather than nuts and bolts day-to-day training of participants and that sort of thing.
Well, actually, we have a chief operating officer position that is doing most of what you're talking about. I tend to be doing mostly external and fund development and generating resources and supporting kind of a long-range sustainability of the organization. So I am not really involved very much at all on sort of the operational aspects of what we're doing.
Okay. You're trying to keep the mission ongoing in a forward-thinking, multi-year sort of way.
Yeah.
Okay. Fabulous. So did you begin this program? Well, I guess either one of them. Were you in at the beginning of the Southwest Conservation Corps or the Veterans Green Jobs?
I was sort of the Veteran Green Jobs. I was involved from the very beginning, pretty much, and was found one of the first board members that came on once we established a sort of a real board besides the initial two people to put on the paper to get the organization off the ground. when I came on, it had an annual budget of $20,000 a year when I started getting involved, and now it's much, much more than that. And with the Southwest Conservation Corps, that formed as a result of the merger of two different organizations. So I was the head of one of the organizations that merged. It was called Southwest Youth Corps, and I came on after it had been around for 6 years.
Okay, great.
So that's
So that gives me two directions to ask for what I really wanted to talk to you about. So at the beginning of any enterprise, there are significant challenges at startup, and maybe even more so for a nonprofit, because you don't necessarily have a lot of revenue or product or anything like that, so that it creates its own challenges there. Can you describe some of the challenges that you experienced during the startup of both of these organizations?
I think a huge startup is just startup and just funding.
Mm-hmm. Right.
How do you get resources? And I think the second one is credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you gain credibility with your funders and partners? And then I think a third one is staffing. You have the right staffing team in place, and you have people who can do many different things because you're not big enough to specialize, and you have people who are frankly willing to work really, really hard to pull something off.
Right.
That would be kind of three biggies I would think of right off the bat.
Okay. And so at that startup, did you use the same kind of model that you use now, where you sort of build a partnership, you maybe do some volunteer work to craft that partnership and solidify it? Is that how you initially began as well?
Yeah, that's how you begin, but mm-hmm. it's tricky because you need typically some grant money to help support you while you're doing that.
Okay.
So in many ways, that's the challenge.
Okay. And how about in the merger of the two conservation organizations? What did you find challenging there?
Initially, the biggest challenge was that they were 500 miles apart. A lot of nonprofit mergers are done with organizations that are in the same community but have slightly different missions. We had very similar missions, but we're very far apart. So there's some geographic concerns with that. And then I think as it went on, sort of merging the cultures of the two organizations. And then probably the biggest hurdle for us was changing from being a sole organization where everyone was in the same building to having multi-site operations with people in different places.
Okay. And what about now that the Corps is so much bigger and the Veterans Green Jobs are so much larger? Is it just a question of scale, or are there different problems that arise in a more complex organization?
That's a good question. I would say it's probably some of each.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we figure out some of the problems. You know, I think we have a structure that works much better now. We put things together, that goes well, but then, you know, what we're dealing with now is how to systemize and codify many of the things that we were just doing because we always did them. In other words, we were small enough that we could have a different procedure for two different staff because we just made it work. But now we're big enough, we need a written procedure that everyone follows. So it's a matter of sort of codifying and figuring out what we're doing at that level while also wanting it just to have the feel for everyone that we're all part of one organization.
Okay. Great. Let's ask you just a little bit more in general. How do you think your career and all the experiences that you've had during your life, how do they inform and guide your management of the program? I mean, are you a really domineering, angry kind of manager? It doesn't sound like it. That's for sure.
No, I think, you know, to put something in there, I mean, it's a hard question to answer in such a broad perspective, but I would say that one of the most important things is to surround yourself with as many smart and educated and experienced and clever and good people as possible, and then let them do their job so that I see my role much, much less as running the organization as supporting the people who are out there doing the good work and doing everything I can to get them the resources and the tools and the support they need to do a good job. And we've always had, for instance, a reverse org chart where at the top of our org chart are the people in the field, crew members, crew leaders, and individual interns. And under them are the folks supporting them on the front line, the recruiters and the logistics folks, and then the program directors and our senior management, and you know, ultimately me, and then the board at the very bottom. Because those are the people that matter, and they're the ones doing the most important work, and we're all trying in our own part of what we're doing to support them.
Well, I tell you,
and to go ahead. Keep that mindset and keep, you know, any big ego out of it, it makes it a whole lot easier and better to have a supportive and strong organization.
Well, I tell you, sir, in my reading and study of things in the entrepreneurship classes that I've taken, and also in just my experience outside of that, I think what you've described is what I've found to be over and over again considered the most effective way to do things is to surround yourself with very strong, independent, and active people. So I think you're doing a fabulous job there. My last question for you is what advice would you have for someone considering the formation of a conservation corps?
Advice is to look around at who else is out there doing similar things and see where there are opportunities to partner. A conservation corps is a fairly expensive program to operate because you're paying all the participants, so the cost per participant is much, much higher than sort of a lot of other nonprofits. It's also the kind of program that to get it to a sustainable level, there's sort of a threshold that I think right now is around $1.5 billion budget just to be sustainable, and that anything smaller than that really doesn't work for the long term. So you got to sort of have a place where you can get to a fairly good size pretty quickly. And anyone sort of starting a nonprofit or within another nonprofit trying to grow a program to $1.5 billion budget, it's a fairly daunting task. What's happening nationally in the Conservation Corps movement, where a lot of the corps are consolidating, like the merger we did, and sort of growing, and we're having this fewer corps and more larger regional programs. So I would advise folks to sort of look into the existing network of corps, and you can go to, there's a national group called the Corps Network. If you Google that, you can get to the list of where all the programs are. There's also a national corps called the Student Conservation Association. Their website, I think, is .sca.org. But looking at those organizations and seeing where you could tie into something that's already going on would be my first big advice, rather than trying to start from scratch. And if you are starting from scratch, if sort of none of that works, is then working with the core network and the people who are already out there to learn everything you can from the existing cores. Because in general, the cores are very happy to share and support each other. It's a terrific network of programs.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for this interview. This has been an interview for the Western Carolina University Entrepreneurship Series. My name is Asia Wilson, and I have just completed an interview with Harry Brule, who is CEO of the Southwest Conservation Corps and a board member of the Veterans